Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're doing the second half of our interview with Amy Carey. She's Executive Director of Sound Action, an organization that is focused on bringing science to bear on the permitting processes that affect sound health and ensuring to the extent they can that regulations are followed. In today's concluding episode, we'll be talking about what the future of the sound is and what we can do to reverse our destructive course and start building toward a healthier and sustainable sound. So here we go with the second half of our conversation with Amy Carey. So you made reference a little while ago, I think you used a phrase something like a ever-narrowing window of opportunity to bring the sound back or something like that. So talk more about that. I mean, where are we in terms of the health of the sound?
We're losing that fight desperately. And, you know, and this is not new. We can look at the population declines, the habitat declines. This has been decades in ongoing. And, you know, we can talk about some of the things that are a little more obvious of, you know, we talk about forage fish a lot. We have herring populations that are a fraction of what they were historic. The same with salmon populations. And we know this with our orcas. And not only are we not making progress decades into, you know, when I think there became an awareness of, you know, in the 70s when certain laws came into place and things like that, or there was really an awareness of what was happening. We're not making progress. We're losing ground. And honestly, I realize I'm sort of always the Pied Piper of regulatory processes, but this is why. Because we're not, our regulatory agencies are not appropriately applying the laws. And sometimes that means saying no to permits or having, you know, making sure that they're protecting habitat. But this is why we're losing this fight. It's not a mystery. I mean, certainly there's complexities of when you talk about things of like climate change and some of the different ocean conditions and things, there are things that have far more complexity. But habitat loss specific to sort of shoreline development is not rocket science. We know why we are losing, you know, these species and these habitats. And we even know what to do about it. We're not doing it. And that really does become, when I talk about how important permitting and the regulatory process is, that is where the rubber meets the road, is, you know, is this unfettered sort of development.
So what I would like to do here, it may be a bit of a stretch, but is to kind of step back and ask the question, what is it about our culture or our societal structure or our economic system that is causing us to be on this long-term losing mode when it comes to the health of the sound?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as I've said, certainly the regulatory process is the gatekeeper, right? And so if that is failing, then, you know, then that's just failure. I think sometimes I can see there's, you know, there's different sort of cultures within agencies. You might have, sometimes issues where, you know, certainly we need our agencies to be funded fully for the job that they're supposed to be doing. You need to give them all the tools to do their best job. There's certainly some political backlash sometimes, or at least that there's a concern of that. That's you might have legislative elected officials who, you know, either want laws weakened, or try to sort of put pressure on agencies by threatening budgets and things like that. And, you know, as far as, so I, you know, I think about this a lot of why is that so, how do these systems get so entrenched? And it's not just in Washington State. This is everywhere, right? How do they get so entrenched? And there's bureaucracy that, you know, all of those things. I wish I had the answer, right? Because everybody's job would be a lot easier if we knew how to fix these things in a, you know, the magic wand sort of way. But I think that it is kind of a recipe of probably many different things. And yes, you absolutely will have some folks in communities that, you know, think laws, same thing, should be weakened, should be repealed. Don't tell me what to do. But I do really believe that that part is shifting.
Really?
Well, I mean, I shouldn't say it's shifting that suddenly the folks who are like diehard property rights people are saying, oh, I get this. But I think in the more middle of the road of that, if people are understanding that a regulation is in place, not just because somebody thought it would be fun, right? There's a cause and effect to it. Here's why you're doing this.
So if you did have that magic wand you just referred to, I mean, what are some of the things that you would change that could turn us around and have the sound starting to recover?
Well, I think, when we know that there are great restoration projects out there, they need to be funded fully. But we're losing habitat right now still faster than we can possibly restore. So if I had that magic wand, I'd turn back to the regulatory process being applied robustly and with some precautionary principle to it. Not just a complete like, well, we're worried this might happen hypothetically, but recognizing that we know things. We know shade impacts submerged aquatic vegetation and juvenile salmon. And, you know, there are things that we know. And we can't just continue to have this. If you want something, you get to build it just because. Shoreline Armoring is a great example. We've actually changed some of the laws now so that single family residential permits, bulkheads are required by law under the hydraulic code to have a site analysis. Do you really have erosion? Is this really happening? Do you have something you're actually needing to protect? Is it at risk? And how do you address that? There are different mechanisms you can use. That's what the law says. And yet we still see every single bulkhead permit for new armoring that comes in rubber stamped and approved. And so I'm saying that as examples of if we continue down that path, or every dock getting approved, often without any mitigation requirements. The same thing with those bulkheads. You know, that's what my magic wand would be. Please apply the law appropriately, and sometimes that is going to mean. I mean, if the law says if you're not able to protect fish life, you know, because sometimes you can't mitigate away every damage, every harm. You know, and so sometimes we've got to get to know. There are no permits, honestly, that are shoreline permits that are denied. And you know, historically, that had always been the case at the federal level, too. That's shifting a little bit more at the federal level right now, where they've actually brought in some more robust tools that the National Marine Fisheries Services and NOAA has brought in. But that's part of it, too. We've got to get to know, not, you know, recreational docks with 50-foot pleasure boats that, you know, these are killing. This is how we're getting into this position. In many ways, I think it's the smaller projects that cumulatively are having the bigger impact than, you know, sort of one larger industrial thing.
Those are some really intriguing perspectives. And I can imagine that an owner of some shoreline who's, let's say, relatively affluent, and they want to have their boat out front and so on, they've got a specific individual desire to have that. And it's very difficult for a lot of people to see the bigger picture, like to say, well, look, there's docks all over the place. Why can't I have a dock?
Yeah.
And so on. So, and I think really you're touching on that earlier question that I asked is, what is it about our culture or our worldview as a social entity that leads us to make these unfortunate choices that while they work for an individual, they don't work for us as a community over time?
Well, if we had the answer to that question, we'd all, you know, but I think it's a great question. And I think we see different perspectives of that, shades of that too, because there are the people who, you know, are saying, no, I realize that this is a problem and I'm going to do this or not do, you know, or they're going to make some changes themselves. But, and if we had a really robust Puget Sound and, you know, great. I get it. Everybody loves, I like standing at the end of a dock, though I enjoy it much less anymore starting to do this work because it could be picturesque and lovely and beautiful. And my brain, it's hard for me to go take recreational walks on the beach because all I can just see like, right. Oh, that there's that you know, the dying out eelgrass bed, the kelp, the, all of these things. But, you know, I get it. They're, you know, but we have to have that awareness of our actions.
So you may, we've talked some about habitat and species, and you've made reference to salmon, herring, orcas. What other habitats and species do you see that are significantly at risk right now?
Well, honestly, I think if you took a long list of the different types of habitats and species that are in the Sound and the Salish Sea, most of them is the very sad answer that we know, right? I mean, there's always more bodies of research that are needing to be done. Because when we talk about like the herring declines, but then we're also talking about surf smelt and sandlance and their habitat, because it all, of course, is this link, right? Here are these forage fish, for example, which are, I talk a lot about little fish plus big fish equals orca. You know, you're talking about backbones of a food web. And so, and this also brings back when I said that tiniest grain of sand. And I bring this forward because it's, you know, so sandlance and surf smelt, for example, which are, they're what we'll call primary producers, right? They take all the energy up into the food chain. And they spawn on the highest reaches of the beach where bulkheads are, or where bulkheads that change how the sediment moves. They have very specific sediment requirements as well. So, and I bring that up because it ties sort of this whole thing together, right? Of when you have collapse of these things, this is what, you know, juvenile salmon are not making it out of Puget Sound alive.
Yeah.
You could have 10 gazillion million salmon coming out of the streams in this area, and if they're, but they're not making it out to the sea because of the habitat loss. Eelgrass, kelp, macroalgae, which are the vegetations that, you know, we don't talk about quite as much, but they serve similar purposes for both food webs and juvenile salmon, whether they give, they help create food, they give refuge, they, you know, provide in some cases for herring, it's where they spawn, all of those things. And so the sad thing of this is when you're having collapse of full systems and full food webs, it puts everything at risk. Every species is, for the most part, you know, aside from things maybe like, I'm thinking like pile perch and shiner perch that have a different abundance and that we don't really study, so we don't really know much about what their populations are doing. But we don't really have anything that's just like doing great and increasing. And there's some knowledge gaps out there too, because, right, if you don't go study something or you don't capture data on something, you may not know exactly.
So one of the images that's coming to me, maybe image is not the right word, I tend to think of the Sound as a really powerful thing. I mean, it's huge. It covers thousands of acres. My office overlooks the Tacoma Narrows, and I love watching the current come in and out. And I've boated out there, so I know how powerful that thing is.
Yeah.
But one of the things, maybe the thing I'm picking up from you is it seems strong, but it's not. It's really fragile.
Incredibly. And I think it was something that, like many things in nature and the environment, right? If we get out of the way, it does okay. we're the one, we've caused this problem. This is not some mystery. And it is interesting with particularly, I think, you know, these habitats that you really don't see per se. And so it can look beautiful. It's very deceiving. Mm-hmm. You can look at the Sound. You can still see, you'll still see whales and seals and you'll see these things. And so you would think everything's fine. Below the water line is a different story.
Right.
And when you look at, again, the wider sort of habitats and ecosystem there.
So during the permitting process, the way it is now, is climate change ever a consideration in permitting either on the macro or the micro level?
It's moving towards that. And where we see some of that at the federal level, they are bringing in, bringing it into the conversation some. As part of their review, they're looking at how you can have some of that intersection with the habitats. I think where we see a little bit more of it rising into the dialogue is, with permitting, the kind that we look at, or the state sort of shoreline permits may have less to do with when you're talking about, you know, pH changes and different things like that, or even, but weather changes and how, and where we're anticipating sea level rise and shoreline armor. So it's this kind of big jump, but it, those are the dot to dots of when you're having increased weather systems that, or altered weather systems, I guess, that are creating, whether it's different winds or different storms, you could potentially have increased erosion rates. You're combining that if there's sea level rise, what's happening to that. So I think it's part of the conversation. I don't yet see it being a strict part of a review process. Like, it's not a part of the hydraulic code review process at all.
Understood. So we are getting close to the end here, but just a couple other things I wanted to talk about a little bit. Of course, we've got a legislative session coming up in 6 months or so. Anything there as concerned citizens we should be watching for around the health of the Sound?
Yes. Well, I would say watch us, because we go, okay. That's a big part of what we do, recognizing that, you know, when you're looking to these regulatory processes, you have to be on both sides of that, of making sure the laws applied appropriately, making sure laws are improved where we know we need to go, and that they aren't weakened, because we are in that place where they are attacked every year. So we work down with in Olympia every year, and generally run legislation. And I'm anticipating we're working on a project that would be doing, I call it the Google Street Maps for Puget Sound, but on the water surveys, we don't have a baseline right now. Nobody's like really knows exactly what's going on where. And so capturing that, improving some mitigation. Every year there's new funding requests that need to go in for some of the science studies that happen. So there's pretty much always going to be something there that's on Puget Sound. And we're already starting to work on that. Session starts in, you know, January, but the work starts now every year.
Well, so one of my questions for you, of course, is what can we as ordinary citizens do? And that sounds like a big part of it, is that to know what's going on down in the legislature and to raise our voices. I know personally that I think a lot of people think, well, I'm just one voice and they already know what they're doing and the big guys are going to get their way anyway, so why should I bother? But I've personally experienced legislators thrilled to get ordinary citizen input on what's going on down there. So go ahead.
It's a huge part of the process. And whether it's, you know, and there's so many different ways. You can sign when there's hearings, you can sign in support. You can reach out to your own elected, you know, whoever's representing in your area. And absolutely, it both lets them know from their constituents what is important, and it gives them some political cover too, honestly, And lets them know that somebody's watching.
Yeah, you know, I get the political cover piece, and I go down to Olympia every once in a while to actually be there in person. At least before COVID, I did. And one of the things I always noticed was there were these people roaming around in their business suits and their briefcases, looking really sharp. And mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, those people are not ordinary folks. They're down here with an agenda, and they've probably got some money to bring with them, and so on. So that's what we're up against.
Yeah, you absolutely. And this is where it does get pretty tough, because, you know, suddenly down there, we're not talking, at least for our work and others that we partner with in the environmental community, we're talking often about bigger picture stuff and making that change. And that is where you do have then big development, big whatever, you know, there is a wall of opposition. Yeah. And it can be really tough. So I was on when Governor Inslee a few years back created the Orca Task Force. I was an appointed member of the prey availability work group, which was to try to figure out how do we make more salmon. And, you know, we went through these very extensive processes there to identify the changes to make that in some ways were not that difficult, and that they were intended by design to then become sort of legislative steps. And I bring that up both to share that, you know, we have this sort of list of things to do, but even that, then once you started trying to work it through, you know, you're meeting opposition on sometimes what should be very simple.
Yep. Well, sobering, but it also kind of points the way that we need to be focused in going forward. And citizen involvement has got to be a huge part of all of these kind of environmental issues, and especially this one, especially for those of us who live around the Puget Sound.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I think people really love the sound, but there's a lot of people that don't know that how much trouble the sound is in. And hopefully our conversation today will help point the way on that. So anything else, Amy, that you'd like to bring up before we finish up here?
I think that's it. And I just, you know, I appreciate the opportunity, and it really is, it is up to us to win this fight. Our elected leaders are, I mean, it is, they're not going to, they're going to help, and they can be part of that, but this is up to us.
I love the clarity of that. It's up to us. So with that, Amy, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. I learned a lot, got some nuances in particular that I never really had a handle on before. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you again for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
So here are some of my takeaways from this very informative conversation with Amy Curry. Day by day, year by year, the health of our beloved sound, our Salish Sea, is declining and is in peril. If we continue on the path we're on, the fragile, intricate web of the environments that the living things in the sound rely on for their existence, they're going to be gone. Given our present political and economic system, the only way to protect the sound is via regulation. It's up to us as ordinary citizens to raise our voices to make sure that we have appropriate regulations and that those regulations are followed. You can be sure that the representatives of the financially driven are everlastingly chipping away at our environment, chipping away to the point of destruction. As Amy says, most residential shoreline permits are rubber stamped without any investigation of the ongoing harm caused by our constant degradation of our natural shoreline environment. I'm going to be talking to Amy Curry again in mid-November or so to bring us up to date on what we can expect from the next legislative session so that we can bring our voices to bear. You can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. Bunch of good people. Join up or find an organization to join your voice with others if you aren't already attached. In the meantime, this program, with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. So until we talk again, remember, all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.